Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our studio, and Nancy Lawrence, coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. And we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful, as always, for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia Law School, where they investigate wrongful convictions of inmates throughout Virginia. You also may know Deirdre from her appearances on the viral podcast Serial. And we're talking with Grace Elizabeth Haley, a professor of history and American studies at the University of Virginia. We'll discuss race in the South and her book, Making Whiteness. And if you have questions for our guests during the show and you're on Facebook, message us on Facebook there at 947WPVC, and we'll take your questions. If you happen to have my cell phone, you can text me questions as well. And usually at this point in the show, I ask Nancy if she's there, and unfortunately the phone, we have some technical problems, so she's here. Let's see if you can hear her. Wait, Nancy.
Yes, I'm here, and I can hear you almost a notch better than a Peanuts character's parent, but I think I got it, and actually that last little bit, it was very clear, so I will stop talking about the technical part.
Well, the main thing is,
I can hear you, Ellen. I can hear you.
The main thing is that we can hear you. And Dennis on the board here is dealing with levels, you know, Okay. Interesting things like that. So I'm very glad you're here.
Oh, you sound totally. This sounds perfect. I have to say.
Okay, it's all okay. Good. So I wanted to talk about an iceberg that broke away from Antarctica. It weighed a trillion tons. Did you hear about that?
Yes.
And it's the size of Delaware. And what I want to know is, how's the water level there in New York City?
Apparently, it's affecting the phone lines. No, I don't know. Well, now that Chris Christie has removed himself from the shoreline, maybe he's responsible too. You know, I'm not sure. He seems to be photoshopped everywhere, so I guess I shouldn't be blaming any of what you're describing on him at this point.
Yeah, and I think you like this.
I know. Ellen, the stuff that comes across the crawl, I mean, why don't they just replace it all with just small little fire emojis? I didn't see that, and that is... The level of that news should be, I don't know, one, maybe. So, but yet it just, that's how I learned
it's
about
alarming.
It.
It's alarming.
Just like coming across the crawl.
Right,
hey,
right.
The world is melting. Meanwhile,
Can I say one more thing about that is, I think you'll like this, that a piece of iceberg, when it melts, the fizzling sound or the fizzing sound that it makes is called the Bergie Seltzer.
Well, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down. It's sounding adorable. It's excellent. How comforting.
And the physics behind it is something like bubble wrap. Things are, you know, when that trapped air bubbles get met by the ice and water, things pop. So all we can do is laugh and resist.
Well, you know, maybe I won't hear half of it if it sounds anything like, you know, what happens when the phone lines get compromised. Anyway, I know we're running out of time since we started this with
a bang
ball or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if you do you think we should just bring on Deirdre at this point?
Well, I just wanted to mention one event that there's a Mop in Town Film Festival today at the Jefferson African American Heritage Center. That is one of our former guests, Lorenzo Dickerson, I believe, is involved with that. And there's 15 films. It's completely free. It goes on today and tomorrow. It was also yesterday. And there's speakers and presentations as well. So I think that's really cool.
That does sound cool.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to stick this one in 30 seconds. Is the FCC, they're trying to take away naturally, they're trying to take away the net neutrality of the internet. To right now, everyone has free access to anything and everything, but they're trying to take that away. The Trump administration, he just hired two opponents to that. So, in very briefly, we have, as Americans, till the 17th to express, to comment that we want it to remain open. That's expires on the 17th of July, but if you go to gofccyourself.com, all one word, you can leave a comment that you want it to remain free and open so that it doesn't become another political football infused by money, by, you know, the ISPs that want to control the information and the agenda and line
Thank you.
Politicians' pockets.
That's great. Thank you so much. So I want to introduce our first guest. She is Deirdre Enright, Director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law, where students investigate and litigate wrongful convictions of inmates throughout Virginia. And as I mentioned, she had a couple appearances on Serial, but they've worked on many, many cases since then. Welcome, Deirdre.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hold on. Say that again, Deirdre.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great. So tell us about the Innocence Project. What is it?
So there's a network of Innocence Projects around the globe, and we are just one of many Innocence Projects, mostly attached to law schools, but some are freestanding. The New York Innocence Project started the network, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, and maybe 10 years ago, the dean asked me to propose a project at the law school, and we started with just 12 students and who stay with us for an academic year, but the interest was so profound that we now have a volunteer group that has 50 to 75 law students, and they do it for pro bono hours, and then we have the same 12 clinic students who are with us for a year investigating cases.
Deirdre, what kind of cases do you take on? Like, do you have a set of criteria that gets met to take on a case?
So, unlike a lot of Innocence Projects who only do DNA cases, cases where there's physical evidence that where the DNA can be submitted for testing that would exonerate a person, we take every different kind of case. So we have arson cases, homicide cases, shaken baby cases, junk science cases, eyewitness cases. So sort of every level of crime that can be reinvestigated, because, of course, the error rate for DNA cases shouldn't be any different than it is in non-DNA cases, or at least no one has proven otherwise. So, and basically, we just have them in a queue dated. We have a backlog of about 700 cases, and we probably have 12 at any given time in our clinic, and then 12 in our pro bono clinic as well. So it's slow going, and it can take years and years, or it can take no time at all. Recently, a person came forward and confessed to a crime for which a man was in prison already. He went to the police station. He confessed. He cried. He wept. He had no idea anyone was in prison for that crime. And that guy got out in about a week, and he was convicted very shortly thereafter. That was a really fast case. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, we have cases right now that we've been working on for years, and we could work on for years, depending on whether the state joins or opposes us.
So why, in your opinion, are people wrongfully imprisoned to begin with?
So we usually point at about 7 to 10 sort of common errors that happen. So junk science has been a big one. Eyewitnesses are in 3/4 of the cases, turn out to be wrong. There's, you know, forensic, there's false confessions, there's bad policing, there's tunnel vision, and usually it's more than one of those things. Bad lawyers, bad prosecutors, bad defense attorneys, it's a combination usually of those things.
And I know that there's no repercussions for that, you know, when someone, or are there?
Mostly no. People worry. People, defense attorneys say, ask us all the time, am I going to lose my license? Prosecutors, they will not. Prosecutors are mostly immune for what they do, bad or good, in the courtroom. So police are the people that can be sued, but they often have partial sovereign immunity for what they've done. So, you know, when you read about a former prosecutor who turns over his license and spends 10 days in jail in Texas, that's an anomaly. That doesn't happen.
Deirdre, how many, roughly, in your opinion, how many innocent people are inmates in state prisons? At least in Virginia, I know that's basically your scope, but if you know larger than that, please answer both.
So this is the terrifying thing, and I think it should be terrifying to everyone, is that we have no idea how many people are innocent. We know from the New York Innocence Project that of the people who ask for DNA testing, and there is material to test, and it can be tested, and it can exonerate somebody, you know, that the it works in 45% of the cases to exonerate. But that is the tip of the iceberg. We have no idea, you know, and people talk about this all the time. Like, if there were plane crashes this often, everyone would stop flying. and we would look into it, and we would have, but the only people looking into cases in post-conviction setting are innocence projects and death penalty resource centers, because there's a guarantee that if the death penalty is on the table, that they get post-conviction relief. But for the most part, when people are convicted, their families have run out of all resources. And I imagine that most inmates give up hope and can't bear constantly trying to file pro se petitions that will get them nowhere. So the real truth is no one knows how often they happen, and no one is looking besides us. So our answers can only be sort of anecdotal.
So are you saying it's only your group that is doing this kind of work, or are there a few others?
No, I mean, there's different attorneys who do habeas litigation, post-conviction litigation. But I know of maybe three lawyers in Virginia who do it. They charge $50,000 to review the case, and then another $50,000 if they get a hearing, which is highly, highly unlikely. So we really, really don't know. And we only have these tiny groups that have backlogs like we have, who are looking into it. And, you know, we'll never get up to speed in our backlog, not in my lifetime.
We're speaking with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence. Oh, Nance.
Here for a while. I'm sure you don't approve of it.
She couldn't hear me.
Why is it the law in Virginia that defendants are not allowed to see the evidence that the prosecution has?
So there's
and is that unusual? Because I don't even know if it's nationwide.
Yes. No. Their discovery, which is what you get pre-trial, in Virginia, is incredibly limited. You get to see your client's own statement. You get the forensic reports. You don't have access to police reports. You don't have access to almost anything. And often it's what we find later, accidentally in post-conviction litigation, that we find out that exculpatory evidence was withheld, that should have been turned over. And I think a lot of times the reason it's not turned over, if it's not inadvertent, is because everyone is aware of the fact that no one will ever get access to these files, and no one will be looking because no one can afford post-conviction litigation. So it's a nationwide problem, but it is particularly bad in Virginia because we're so limited in what we get to begin with.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law. So, Deirdre, can you talk about some of the cases, interesting cases you've covered in the past, investigated?
Yeah. So we just filed a case recently, and it's a client that we've had for many, many years. His name is Messiah Johnson, and he went out for a drink 21 years ago with a friend. He was seen by a person who had been in a beauty salon that he owned 2 weeks prior, and it had been robbed by two masked gunmen. And of course, like many, many victims, he had been searching visually for the perpetrator for 2 weeks. He saw Messiah at a distance that is disputed, walking through an unlit parking lot into a club, and decided that that was the person who had robbed his beauty salon 2 weeks prior.
Thank you. We're speaking with Deirdre Endright. We'll be back after this break with Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at the UVA Law School. In a few moments, we're going to speak with Grace Elizabeth Haley, professor of history and American studies. We're going to talk all about race in the South.
Deirdre, I know that we obviously went to break, but I wasn't sure you were done with the result of this injustice before we cut to break.
Sure, sure.
I don't want to hit that story.
Well, no, and so just, you know, an eyewitness identified Messiah, and then two more other people who were in the beauty salon followed in suit. One was with him, so of course he ID'd him at the same time. That looked to be the end of Messiah's case right there, because three eyewitnesses stayed with their stories. However, we went through archives of newspapers, and we submitted Freedom of Information Act requests and found out that there were two people who were doing armed robberies in the area, or more, two or more, and one of them had pled guilty to four of them and was considered the suspect in 14 others in the same neighborhood at the same time. And we literally went to the prison where he was, surprised him, and he admitted that he had done the beauty salon in the armed robbery pretty quickly. And so we have recently filed this petition for Messiah to have him exonerated. But, you know, that's the cautionary tale to all of us. If you look like someone, even somebody who wore a disguise, right? He went out for a drink and hasn't been home in 21 years. Horrible.
Yeah.
Don't go out for a drink.
I know this is a clinic for students. I was just curious, what kinds of work do they get to do as students for all these important cases?
So we literally have them with us at every juncture. So a student went with me to meet the man who actually did the crime. They go to prison. They get to know the client. They draft the petitions. They draft all the affidavits. They file the Freedom of Information Act requests. They literally do every step of the way. And we stay in touch with them years after they leave the clinic and pressure them strongly to take cases wherever they end up, because they, of course, know the cases better than anybody. And they're compelling cases. It's really hard to do one of these cases and not want to stay on.
How did you get involved in this work, and whose brainchild was this project?
The brainchild of this project was me, but I stole it directly from Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, so I can't claim it. So the reason I got involved is this. I worked at a law firm before I went to law school, Skadden Arps in D.C., and I really couldn't find myself interested in a lot of the work that they did, but a partner took a death penalty case in Texas, and I ended up being in El Paso, Texas with an attorney for probably a year and a half, and the guy on death row turned out to be the wrong guy. It took us 7 years of litigation. I went to law school and graduated and met my husband and married in the time they litigated. And when we got that guy out, he lived with me and my husband during our first year of marriage while he tried to, you know, get back on his feet. So I sort of thought, if the first guy I ever worked on is innocent, then there's just got to be many, many others. And that's turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a ray of sunshine, am I not?
No. I think this is really important for us to be aware of. Can you talk about the justice system, or, you know, what you think?
Without cursing?
Yeah, I mean, what's going right? What can people do, or what do you think can be done?
Well, reform, of course. All of the mistakes I'm talking about could still happen today. We have not kept up. So even though junk science has been turned on its head and we now know many, many different ways that we've been wrong in the past, nobody's reviewing the cases unless, you know, the cases come to us. So there needs to be systematic review of cases, and if it's going to be done by clinics like ours, then they need to be better funded and there need to be more of them, because we should be looking at all these cases and not the ones where the inmate has the resilience to keep fighting after 20 years.
Yeah, that is, and know, that's, you know, as wonderful as the work is when you uncover the injustice, it's just the fact that you all had to be involved in something so wrong to begin with is just so depressing. I was wondering your opinion of, you know, speaking of science, I know Jeff Sessions is going out of his way to eliminate experts, advisory panels, and, you know, keep it all in-house, protect everyone. So I was just wondering, how will that also affect your ability to do your work?
So what he's doing to undermine and disable what is in place, we were barely up to speed in trying to fix these things. The National Academy of Sciences released a report in 2009 that has been incredibly helpful. And he is basically saying we should turn back the clock, and the clock is already way behind. So that is particularly terrifying to me, to see the people that are trying to honestly address issues without a political side to it. They've tried to take science at its word, and now they're being shut down for no good reason.
And what is it about the, I mean, it seems very clear when I read about it, but this whole idea of the hair tracing and bullet analysis that could really be a time saver is also being, you know, like buried, discounted. And those are very clear, right? Those would really speed up perhaps some of these longstanding cases.
So we have several hair cases, right, where people came in at trial and looked at a hair under a microscope and said, this hair looks to be the victim's hair. I cannot exclude the victim as a source of the hair. And then often in our cases, the prosecutor then argues to the jury, and that's just argument, so it's not evidence that in fact it is the person's hair. And jurors who we've interviewed have told us, I convicted based on my belief that it was the victim's hair, right? That there was a forensic link to this case. And almost always, in the three cases, four that we've looked at, it is, you know, you now know you cannot say that that is the person's hair. And if you can do mitochondrial testing now, if you can, if it's not too old, you almost always find that it's an exclusion. So we have a case where not only was it not the client's hair, but they used the word, it's a negroid hair. It was not a negroid hair. It was a hair belonging to a man who had a white mother, at least. That's what you could tell from mitochondrial. And then when the judge ordered that the 11 other hairs be tested, this is Darnell Phillips' case, they destroyed them inadvertently.
Well, before we have to say so long, I want to talk about what might be on some people's mind, the serial experience. And where is that case right now?
I couldn't tell you right now. It was postured to go back to trial. It's been quite a while since the new trial was ordered, so I don't know. I do know, or at least it is my perception, that the DNA in that case remains untested, as it often does in these cases. And the most important takeaway for me for serial is I know that everybody loved that case and followed it, and I am so glad. I couldn't believe how much interest there was. But that is every single case we have. Every case we have is that textured, that interesting, that fascinating, that, you know, you're hooked the same way. Mm-hmm. So that's not an anomaly. That is typical.
How did you wind up consulting on that podcast?
So Sarah had talked to me about another case that we had worked on before, where we ended up picking up the case after she was done with the story. And she literally was just calling me to sort of take her temperature on different issues, to say, is this something normal that would happen in your cases? Is this something abnormal? You know, is use of a cell phone, well, could that tell us where things are? And we ended up talking so often that I finally just said, Sarah, let me just put a team on this. Let's help.
Incredible.
Nothing magical, just legwork.
Most of the work you do winds up in court. So what was it like for you all to see your work sort of being presented, well, definitely being presented on, you know, on the radio, on, you know, on the air versus a courtroom.
Well, so normally I would not advise any client to do what Adnan did, right? Have their situation played out. But that was already agreed to. He had already agreed to do that with Sarah. Like that generated all Innocence Projects getting thousands of offers to turn our clinics into reality TV shows.
Right.
And we could not do that. We would violate every manner of confidentiality if we did that. And we wouldn't know the outcome. So I would never advise a client to do what we actually did. Of course, the students loved it. The students love the exposure, not just for themselves, but for the clients, that they're being paid, that attention is being paid to these people.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law, where they litigate wrongful convictions of inmates throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Well, speaking of noteworthy news, I have one. As the White House always provides so many for me anyway. Secretary DeVos has canceled a critical federal student protection called the Borrower's Defense Rule, which violates her office's responsibility to protect students and families. The idea behind this rule is very simple. It's just to hold fraudulent schools accountable when they cheat students and taxpayers out of billions in loans. And she is siding with the predatory for-profit colleges and school executives, kind of like Pruitt, in that she didn't allow, just like he took rules away by not allowing public input or deliberation, she just simply canceled the protection. It has, which is unlawful, and it has sparked 19 attorneys general to file suit, one of which is in Virginia. So at the moment, though, you know, another major action against
another defeat for humanity.
What do you got? Sorry.
Well, I just wanted to say I saw a 29-second handshake by Macron and Trump.
True. I don't want to steal your thunder, so please go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, it's just amazing, the display. But I just love Macron so, so much.
Yeah. I mean, thank God that guy is a master of faces. But I know, Ellen, I saw that thing, and I just thought this is all he's been doing since he got home from the G20, is practicing this return handshake to this guy. I mean, that's where his priorities. You could so see the choreography and how he was so determined, you know.
But I loved how Macron, it looked like he was trying to distract Trump in the middle of this, somewhere around 20 seconds or so in, by looking at something in the sky, you know. So, but Trump wouldn't loosen his grip. And then at one point, like, Macron... And then Macron looked like at one point also he was like, he was about to stumble because Trump pulled him towards him. I mean, why don't they just, I wish SNL, they need to get on this if they haven't already. I mean, you know.
It should be like cardio in a gym. I mean, this is going to become some sort of upper body exercise, the engagement of this handshake. And you saw, like, Trump incorporated, like, the tap, the diminutive pat, like, that'll show him. I'll pat his hand a couple times.
Right.
Also, he's such a weak man.
Yeah. And the misogyny that accompanied his trip, you know,
it's
just a fraction of what, you know, goes, obviously, what goes on when we don't hear it. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce Grace Elizabeth Haley, a professor of history and American studies at the University of Virginia. She focuses on U.S. cultural history, the U.S. South, documentary studies, and sound studies. She's the author of A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with the Rebellion in Postwar America, and Making Whiteness, the Culture of Segregation in the South, 1890 to 1940. Welcome, Grace.
Thanks for having me. It's Grace Hale, though, I'll just say. You've added a syllable, which is lovely. Maybe it sounds better that way, but it's Hale.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, Nance.
Sure, absolutely. Grace, I was wondering, since a lot of what you write about is inherently the South, what does that term mean to you? You know, how has it been? Well, I don't want to answer the question. What does that mean to you, the South? What does it bring up?
Well, I think in my work, it matters less what it means to me, and it matters what it means to the people that I'm looking at. I'm a historian, so I'm very interested in how people are defining that space and place in the time period that I'm studying. And, you know, different people define it differently in different time periods. And that is part of the work that I actually try to do, is look at how ideas about what actually the South is change over time and change across different groups within the region.
What inspired you to write Making Whiteness?
Well, you know, I was a grad student, so of course I didn't want to tell the personal story, but I think the part that isn't in the book that inspired me is that I grew up in the aftermath of the civil rights movement in the South. I grew up in suburban Atlanta, but my parents were from the small town deep South. And my mom was from southern Mississippi. So I spent most of my time in Atlanta, but I also would go to visit grandparents in Mississippi and Arkansas. And in the time period that I grew up, segregation as a legal construct, as something that the law enshrined in the South, had been defeated. I was born as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were passed. The first school that I went to was always called the Colored Elementary, and no one would really talk about why. I thought it was because the tiles were black and white in the room, in the entryway, because no one would explain what that meant. So I grew up in Atlanta, where people didn't want to talk about these things. But then I would go visit my grandparents in Mississippi, and they were still desegregating the schools in the late 60s and early 70s. I remember when they built the White Flight private school in my grandmother's hometown. They, of course, called it a Christian school. I remember that. I remember the changeover in my lifetime in that place. And trying to figure out how those two things related to each other, it was almost like simultaneously seeing the old South and this new post-Civil Rights South coming into being. And the fact that people didn't want to talk about it really inspired me to look at what was going on in the South that was not about the law and the political economy. As important as those topics were, they had been well studied by historians. It seemed to me, growing up in the post-Civil Rights era South, that there was a lot left to do that the law couldn't touch. You know, how are we going to get at people's ideas, their fantasies, their desires, their ideologies, their fears, things that are beyond the reach of the law? And so in my first book, that's what I set out to try to explain. How do white Southerners do these things?
We're coming up on a hard break, and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Grace Hale, professor of history. We're going to talk more about race when we come back on 94.7 WPVC. This is Apropos of Something. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Grace Hale. She's a professor of history and American studies at UVA. She also wrote the book Making Whiteness, The Culture of Segregation in the South. And I believe, well, Nancy, you can take it, but I believe you're in the middle of speaking.
Grace, in terms of what you were starting to see when the civil rights movement was starting to take effect, why your book, and what's the significance of 1940 as far as the Making Whiteness book that you were?
Well, at the point that I was writing that book, scholars really weren't talking about the long civil rights movement yet, but somehow in the research that I was doing, it seemed clear to me that there was something really different going on that was building in the 30s and really kind of exploded during the war. And I thought that that was the story of in that period, you see the beginnings of the organizing that are going to topple, or not the very beginnings, but a great increase in activism that is going to eventually topple this culture of segregation that I was talking about, or at least its legal and political underpinnings. And so for me, that became a cutoff. I mean, World War II really transforms and changes the international context, the national context, as well as what's going on in the South. So it just seemed, you know, as good a stopping point as any. That's always a problem for historians, because history is, of course, ongoing.
So let's talk a little bit about the KKK before we run out of time. I think you were at the protests. I was as well last week. What's the history of the KKK? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd like to start by just saying that, you know, I feel like white supremacy in the South, as well as in the nation, always has a kind of structural component and an intellectual and psychological component, you know, fantasies, desires, ideas. And I think that during the Obama era, a lot of people felt like we needed to focus on the structural issues, because we really had neglected those, and that we had sort of defeated white supremacy on in the realm of desire and ideas and ideology. And it seems to me that we've been faced with the fact that we were really incorrect in those assumptions, that as much work as needs to be done on the structural issues around white supremacy, there's still a tremendous amount of work to be done in the cultural, ideological, intellectual realm. And the KKK coming to Charlottesville, and the rise of the alt-right, and the alt-right's coming, of course, in a few weeks, really, it seems to me, brings that home. But the KKK is, you know, really a fairly marginal organization, and has been since really it peaked in the 1920s. It was founded, of course, right in the aftermath of the Civil War, but was outlawed, was really persecuted, prosecuted by the federal government, and outlawed during Reconstruction. Of course, it popped back up under different names, and then it was essentially the white terrorist arm of, you know, the defeated Confederates. It was, in a sense, a kind of militia movement. We don't like to think about America as having that kind of thing. Militia movements happen in other places, but that's what it was. It was a group of homegrown terrorists that did not want to go by the law and did not want to accept the defeat of the Confederacy in the Civil War. As I said, that really changed over time. And then in the 1920s, just given the time constraints we have, I'll be brief here, the Klan reemerges in the 19-teens and 20s as a mass organization. The first and only time in American history it is a mass organization. It is strong all over the country. It's strong in Ohio. It's strong in Indiana. It's strong in Illinois, as well as the South. And it really is mainstream in the 1920s, but is really pushed back and rolled back by scandal, and by the changing politics in the country as a result of global economic collapse in the 1930s. And by the time you get to the civil rights movement, the Klan is, for the most part, marginal. It tends to be working class and considered fairly unrespectable. There are organizations like the White Citizens Council that emerge for middle-class, educated white people to oppose the civil rights movement. A lot of scholars call those organizations the country club clans, and the Klan has been marginal ever since. I'm sure your radio station will hear from people who will tell you that they are not marginal and they are Klan, but that is where we are today, and I think that was demonstrated pretty well by the small number of people that came to Charlottesville, as opposed to the number of people that turned out to protest them. Nevertheless, it's a toxic, it's a toxic ideology. It needs to be opposed. The most extreme kind of white supremacy, and they feel now emboldened to put that in public places.
The conclusion that you did have in Making Whiteness, does the past year put any of your vision for a future outside of racism? Does this year affect your opinion of it?
No, I think, you know, maybe it's because I feel like to do the kind of work that I do, I have to be more of a glass half full than glass half empty kind of person, or I couldn't keep at this year after year. But I personally believe that scholars and activists and politicians really discounted virulent white supremacy and really didn't think about the ways that this kind of white superiority had not disappeared over the last few, you know, decades, especially during the time of the Obama presidency. And as much as I believe we really need to tackle structural issues in our country and the way that they enforce and maintain racial inequality, we also still need to work on ideas about white supremacy that are tied to irrational fears of people who are different, that are tied to outmoded and long disproved ideologies like neo-Nazism, and that it, in some ways it's better to see that than to have it be hidden. So I don't find myself to be more depressed by that. I think that scholars of conservatism in America have long discounted that part of conservatism. They've wanted to make conservatism seem modern and rational, and they have chastised historians who want to look at these things. And in some ways, I feel like this is making us really look at the whole range of conservative positions in America in a more realistic way.
Your next, well, I believe it was your next book, A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America, it, to me, sounded, I know you wrote it a while ago, but it sounded like that Trump voter I heard about all election cycle, and still, that the working class Trump voter, is that, looking back at it, do you see that outsider that way?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about that history is the way this romance of the outsider really started as a fringe kind of bohemian thing in American culture, and then became by the 1970s and 80s an idea and a way of understanding a way that people are in the world that the new right picked up and the Christian right picked up and what we might call the extremist right, the racist Klan type people also picked up. And I think that is very interesting, that something that started as a kind of bohemian, alternative, oppositional formation or idea became so much a part of our culture that it's been picked up by everyone. And you see this in the late 90s and early 2000s when the neo-Confederates start to talk about it's our history, it's not hate, it's our heritage. Everybody has a right to their own history, to their own experience. You're denying us our history. I mean, they're really using that kind of language there. So it's interesting to see how much that's permeated society. And, you know, I have had no sort of foresight as a historian, but I do think if you put both of my books together, you're a long way to the Trump voter, because it's a kind of deep fear of difference and a kind of white supremacy coupled with a kind of romanticization of people who don't play by the rules, who are rebels, who were outsiders, who flaunt convention. And it's at least, you know, a pretty powerful formation to put those two ideas together.
You know, and I'm sure I won't be saying this quite right, but it does seem like segregation has further, you know, the power that the white people have in sort of dictating the message. They seem to, like, segregate everything, even in terms of music. Their music is authentic. Their music is country music. It's like they got there first and, like, claimed all these words. Do you feel there's a segregation in that way, in terms of music and the arts in that way?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the most complicated topics in American cultural history, and one that people out in the world really just want to see as simple and do not want to look at the complexity. But let's just speak about country music, for example, and popular music making in the South that becomes commercialized country music is absolutely, I'll use Charles Murray, an African-American intellectual's term from the mid-20th century, but it's a miscegenated culture from the start. It's a mixed culture from the start. It's taking stuff from African Americans and from Europeans and from people all over the country. Musicians are incredibly, I'll use this word to be funny, promiscuous. You know, they hear something, they take it up, they take a style, they take a lick, they take a melody, they take things from each other. They don't care where it comes from if they like it. And so I think when you're talking about music, you always have to be clear that you're talking about a form of cultural expression, but you're also talking about an industry. What's always been segregated in America is the music industry, not music making. Now, I don't want to romanticize musicians and act like they're great beacons of racial justice all the time, because they're not, or equality. All around, people have different opinions and different politics, just like they do in any arena. I just mean that stylistically, musicians mix whatever their political beliefs are, but the industry segregates. And so there is something incredibly tragic about the fact that the music industry, the commercial specialization of recorded music in America happened mostly really explodes in the 1920s at exactly the kind of high point of American, not just Southern, but American racism. And so the industry was completely segregated in its vision of who audiences were, of what people wanted. So country music and the blues and what's going to become rhythm and blues are separated commercially in ways that don't always make sense in terms of style, genre, et cetera. And because of that, whites have always made the majority of the profits in the music industry, whether the innovation is coming, whoever is making the innovation, and often it's African Americans, but sometimes it's white Americans or other Americans. There's a strong tradition of Latino music making across much of the South, for example, but because of segregation, it's marketed to separate audiences, and whites control the industry end and make most of the money.
Mm-hmm. So there's a, it sounds like the consumer culture is constantly at work. Is that fair to say, to like draw sides or to rank what's more American than the next or more legitimate?
Yeah, I think there's always that tension. I mean, I think the thing that's exciting and interesting about consumer culture is there's always room for someone to win by making, doing something in a different way. So, the classic example, of course, is Elvis Presley, who really, in sonic terms, crosses the color line and becomes a megastar as a result of it. But there are many other examples. So stylistically, people cross these lines, and then that carries with it. It's both interesting because it seems new. It also seems transgressive, but it's only all of those things because of the segregation of the music industry to start with. And so I think that consumer culture is interesting because it's always in flux and it's always changing. But it is, in my mind, a tragedy that country music has become such a genre, as a commercial genre, associated with a certain form of conservative politics, because that certainly isn't the history of country music.
Well, I know we're running out of time, so I'm actually I'm very reluctant to ask you another question. Am I right, Ellen? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Well, you can go ahead. Go ahead, Fern.
Grace, I was just wondering, because you have such an interest in the arts, is there any other, be it fashion or photography, that, since you've already talked about music, that has also opened your eyes to this interest you have in the South? Do you have any research in there that you'd like to share?
Well, I've always been interested in the fringe and the bohemian and the oppositional and alternative, because, frankly, if you look at the sort of center of white supremacy all the time, you just have to have some kind of a break from that. And because white supremacy is so central to Southern history across the 20th century, the time period that I study, where you can see people opposing that, when people are trying to oppose the mainstream of society, things get interesting racially. Again, I wouldn't say everybody involved involved in those alternatives is anti-racist in the ways that we might want them to be or for equality. But, for example, if you look at the work of somebody that, like the photographer William Eggleston, who I don't think necessarily has left progressive politics, you can see really interesting things about the racial landscape of the South and his work.
Thank you so much. Really honored to have you here. Grace Elizabeth Hale, her book is Making Whiteness, The Culture of Segregation in the South, 1890 to 1940. Also want to thank our first guest, Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at UVA. And perhaps that's a good segue, this last topic, to we're hoping to have on A.D. Carson, a new professor who wrapped his doctoral dissertation. And for sure, we're going to be speaking next week with Matthew Ruiz from Montpelier. We're going to discuss their new exhibit, African American Transition from Slavery to Freedom. Hey, Nance, we have like 20 seconds.
I do have a palate cleanser. It's a very
20
good
seconds.
One.
15 seconds.
Okay. It's 92-year-old Jimmy Carter, the day after he was hospitalized with dehydration, was back building homes for the poor. And meanwhile, you know, as you may remember, you know, the G7, that's the one we just had, the G7, there's Donald Trump riding in a golf cart, you know, behind all the leaders. But here's Jimmy Carter, 92.
Thank you.
Sprinkle working in Habitat for Humanity. And
I did hear about that. Thank you. I did hear about that. We'll see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Bye, Alan.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Showing hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.